The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The man who passes the sentence should swing the sword.
I've won every battle, but I'm losing this war.
Show them how it feels to lose what they love.
Everyone is mine to torment.
The long night is coming. And the dead come with it.
Beware, spoiler phobes. You have stumbled upon a storm of spoilers. A podcast about HBO's Game of Thrones series in conjunction with the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. This discussion can expand to include any Game of Thrones relevant books, shows, internet extras, special features, teases, trailers, interviews, rumors, guesses, theories, and general crackpotitude. We're not ruining, we're enriching. After all, chaos isn't a pit, it's a ladder. You do not wish to be spoiled or are not caught up, please stop now. Hello, and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have not read any of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I've read all the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. And I'll tell you one thing, I will always be running in a serpentine pattern for the rest of my life, just in case.
I mean, the shortest... the shortest speed between two distances is a straight line. I fucked up that saying, but you can't. You're dealing with a guy, a tiny boy, and then a guy who's hunted humans several times in his life. I just feel like, zigzag or not, I could have seen myself making the same decision. But I'm sure we'll get there. And to a lot of tiny nitpicks in this amazing episode, Battle of the Bastards of Game of Thrones. We're the show that
yes,
lost.
Teeny tiny nitpicks.
Because we're a storm of spoilers, we'll also spend some of this episode speculating about what the Game of Thrones season finale is going to look like based on the next Dawn and our theories about who's going to be lit on fire that seemed like a major spoiler a few weeks ago, but now seem basically inevitable. But first, some meta motes to the Citadel of Crazy Town business. Joanna, I hear we got some reviews this week.
We do. I'm going to read one, as is my wont, I'm going to read one negative review, one positive review. The negative review is Meh, 3 stars by SD Reviews. And they wrote, so much negativity. What's up, guys? I don't understand why, now that you can't rely on book knowledge, you consistently assume the worst of the show. There's so much symbolism and thematic texture that is there that you don't bother to discuss while complaining that things are done poorly. I'm bummed things have gone in this direction. You guys are my favorite. Dave is still my favorite. Joanna's perspective is often such a downer. That rest assured, gentle listeners, Neil was very up on this episode, so you will have a nice pH balance when we get into the plot of Battle of the Bastards. Our second review is from Summer, mother of cats, and she writes, I have voice crushes on them all. Spoiler alert, Joanna, Dave, and Neil are the prophesized three heads of the dragon. These three always make me feel right at home, and it made me actually look forward to my Atlanta morning commute. It has gotten to the point where when the season is over, I get more sad about not hearing my quote-unquote friends each week than I am about the season ending. The lovely hosts bring insightful theories and discussion, as well as evident passion and enthusiasm for both the show and the book series. Cheers to your fearless leader of the Citadel on Crazy Town. Long may they reign. Heart emoji. I will just point out that Summer did specifically ask for me on Twitter to read that in her accent. Summer, great longtime listener, terrible Atlanta accent. Thanks for your reviews, guys.
That was good. That was real good.
Was it? Was it real good, or was it like
it was real good?
Or was it like, oh my stars and gold?
Well, I think Summer is a voice actress as well, so I think she knows
she is
exactly what was right and wrong about that accent. I'm sure she enjoyed it muchly. You guys can leave us reviews, and if you want Joanna to attempt your accent, that's something we do by request. We also have more business, so much more that Neil has his own little business section now. Neil, nice. What's going on?
I'm getting my business files together. Lots of business.
Yes. I do all the business. An accordion file, I hope, just for all of them.
I'm going to get some cards that just say, Neil, I do business. Anyway, some business. You can, if you'd like to interact with us, obviously leave us a review. Send us an email, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Tweet at us @stormofspoilers. You can also now leave us a tip, which has been going extremely well, and we appreciate every dollar you guys have donated to the show. You go to paypal.me/stormofspoilers. So paypal.me/stormofspoilers. And then the big news that we released last week after being spoiled by Matt Patches is that we are going on an off-season tour. So we are going to be doing Storm of Spoilers year-round, which means we're all getting in a boat together and we're going to sail off to other pop culture lands. And we've decided that our schedule looks like this. Next week, obviously, we're going to be talking about the season finale, season 6. The following week, we're going to do a big season 6 recap show. And then the week after that, we will be talking Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, of which I have no details whatsoever. Joanna and Dave are going to have to explain it all to me because I don't do the Harry Potter thing. So very excited about that and all the other fun lands that we will visit in the off season. And then, of course, we may intermittently stop in at the Citadel and update on Game of Thrones, especially if the Grand Maester himself graces us with a new tome.
Oh, God, please let George release the book before next season. Also, we did get our first bit of season 7 casting news this week. I don't know if this is an appropriate place to briefly mention it.
Season 7 is going to have kids in it.
Well, northern teenagers, which, if you want to extrapolate, could maybe hint at more flashbacks to the Stark house.
Or
maybe
a love interest for Lyanna Mormont.
She's tiny. She's too young. No.
Or we just killed off all the northern men needlessly because somebody didn't mention the Knights of the Vale were coming. That's right. We're talking about Episode 9, Battle of the Bastards. We're not even going to get to what Sansa Stark did or did not say, because first we have to go to Meereen where we get some dragon action, and it is completely obvious to Dave Polygons Gonzalez that they saved so much budget to create this entire sequence, which I found very impressive. I was very happy to see Jacaerys happen to some boats. And I think that it was really impressive using the rig for Daenerys so that we could pan around as she's riding Drogon, and finally Drogon gets his brothers to light some shit on fire. I'm also happy about how Tyrion sort of returned to a proper advisory role, and I don't know. I haven't been happy with Meereen in a while, so all of this was, knowing that the Battle of the Bastards was coming later in the episode, was just thrilling and started my hopes rising towards the ceiling. Neil, dragons? You like dragons?
I'm with you. I had the similar thought while watching, especially the shot. My favorite shot is the one where the Wise Master is telling Daenerys about all the ways that she's going to be in trouble, and you could see Drogon in the background, and you're just like, oh shit, here it comes. But the polygons were great. I mean, those dragons looked awesome. The whole sequence was awesome. This really was, for me, the best part of the episode, because it is something that we've been waiting to get to for so long, and as Joanna has written about at great length, feels like we've wasted a lot of time on the path to getting here, but it kind of felt worth it. So my whole Sunday night was about things that I've waited for a long time to see, and it was totally worth it in the end. But I love the I love Tyrion getting his groove back. The conversation between Yara and Daenerys is pretty fantastic. And it was nice to see Grey Worm get to do something other than get stabbed and watch Ser Barristan die, which is pretty much all he's done in, like, I don't know, the last 10 episodes.
Yeah, no, so. he got to kill two men with one deft swipe.
Yep. So it was pretty great. Badass. It was also good to see them. Like, we got a little, there was a little back and forth on Twitter after the episode about the Mad Queen theory, which is something that we've talked about a lot. And I don't think it's dead. I think that the show did a lot to show that Daenerys will listen to counsel with Tyrion. She can be talked into forming a decent plan that isn't, I'm going to burn everything down. But she's still a Targaryen. She's still riding really high on power at the moment. She is basically one advisor loss away from being in trouble again. Like, if she lost Tyrion at some point, it would be bad. Or if she decided she didn't want to listen to Tyrion anymore, she could kind of go back down that hole. So I think that's all still in play. But it's awesome to just be able to root for her and watch her torch ships and just obliterate these masters emotionally and then literally. So yeah, the Marine stuff was a home run to me.
It's pretty great, except obviously the Sons of the Harpy are coming back because Varys has been behind it all along, right, Joanna?
Okay, couple of things. I will say even Joanna loved the polygons in this episode. I thought they looked great. The Yara and Dany stuff was fantastic. I think not just contextually in the episode, but also Weiss and Benioff in the post-episode interview threw some cold water in the whole Mad Queen Daenerys thing. If I didn't know that they recorded those interviews like long in advance, I would suspect it as being like targeted at us, the viewers who have been speculating about the Mad Queen. But you know, they sort of said she's not mad like King Aerys is. She is still bringing two large groups known for raping to Westeros, so mm-hmm. We'll see how that goes. But and I agree with Neil that while she may not be the Mad Queen, and she still has that Targaryen arrogance, which you probably have to be arrogant to try to conquer a kingdom. So here we go. The other thing is sometimes Joanna is wrong. And she can admit it. And yeah, enjoy it.
As a man, I feel like I have to make that my ringtone or something.
Sons of the Harpy seems like they're just what they seem to be, which has been the theme of the entire goddamn season. That thing you saw, it's just what you thought it was. I do want to go back and watch that scene to like try to figure out who's watching Varys and Tyrion. And if it's no one, then it's just like a weird, tricky camera angle that they decide to do. Also, the set photo we saw of Sybilka Kelly, who plays Shay in Marine, seeming like she's in costume. I don't know. Like, there's a couple options. One, she actually is like an extra in a scene, and it's just like a fun, like, where is Waldo exercise to try to find her somewhere in a crowded Marine scene. Two, it's a scene we haven't seen yet. Or three, she just likes to dress. Her street clothes are just exactly like what people wear in Marine, because she's Sybilka Kelly,
like,
and she can do
three.
That. But
option
I don't know what's going on.
She's got that SO chic. Slaver's Bay chic.
Yes, yes. Slaver Bay chic, yeah. So I don't know if Shay is coming back or what, but that photo continues to confound me.
I like SO chic because it fits into the boom boom pow rhyming scheme, right? She's got that SO chic. Something something rhymes with chic. off you go, listeners. Get that stuck in your head.
That's a reference to a song.
Yes. The Black Eyed Peas is a musical group, by definition.
Yeah, that one, it's very confusing as to why she was on the set. Although, with all of the... with all the very serious, like, lie-mongering the show and the network did over the course of the offseason, I do think that it's kind of a fun thing to imagine that they were just like, hey, let's invite, like, one or two people who aren't in this season back to the set to just hang out, and we'll pay them for the day. Like, that would make me believe that they are really, truly having fun, which I believe Benioff and Weiss are fully capable of. Because they jumped through hoops on the Jon Snow thing, which was obviously... total lie, but it would be fun to be like, yeah, we're just gonna invite her back for the day and she's not actually gonna be in the show, we're just gonna mess with the bloggers.
Hey Sibel, wear this drapey thing, right? It'll be fun, I promise. Wave at the nice paparazzi, wave. Yep. At them. Great. So pretty, I mean, great. I'm not quite there. I don't believe that they were doing that for season 6, but I believe that they might do that for season 7. Like, given that The Walking Dead is filming, like, every single death scene in order to try to obfuscate from spies, I can't even imagine what season 7 of Game of Thrones, what lengths they're going to go to protect the plot. We shall see.
Well, let's talk Indeed. About Dany's storyline on the show in comparison to what we can expect in Winds of Winter. So... Is the being rescued from the Dothraki and catching up with Drogon and stopping the siege of Meereen all going to be one long Dany motion? Is like that her plot for the upcoming book?
I say Drogon rescues her rather than she burns down the calls herself, which we've talked about. So like, well, also Drogon is just nearby when the Dothraki find her, not... and nearby in a way that he wasn't in this season where he like just disappeared for a couple episodes. But I think they just pulled her plot out. I think it's simply going to be the Dothraki. You're going to see her with the dragon. She's going to head back with the dragon to Meereen, with the Dothraki, save the city from the siege. And it looks like, I don't know, take Victarion up on his offer, possibly. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think? What do you think, Neil?
I think it's very possible that it all ends in a very similar manner. It's just she's going to have to ally with Victarion Greyjoy instead. And I think the Dothraki thing could be even easier than her getting captured. Like Jenna said, it's like maybe they just see Drogon and they're like, oh, shit, maybe we should just follow her. You know, or like Drogon roasts a call in the field or something. I certainly hope that when we think about Winds of Winter, that the entire book isn't what we've seen in season 6. Because if we get to the end of the Winds of Winter and it's like Daenerys still isn't on her way back or has just gotten back to Westeros, that's going to be really tedious. And George, he has a capacity yeah. to fill like that, which is scary.
If anyone can vamp, it's George R. Martin.
So I would hope that this is like a... within the first 200-300 pages of that book, you know, we're to hear where we are right now. Because if you think about it, for George, like from a big plot standpoint, he really has just 2 books left. So he's got to get going with his story stuff as well. I think the potential benefit for him with The Winds of Winter is that the pressure is on to do the same similar thing as what the show's doing, which is brings people together, bring storylines together in with a sense of purpose. So unless he's just going crazy and he's going to actually write like 3 more books. So we'll see.
My crackpot theory, which is not going to pan out, is that George has secretly written both books.
Ooh, I like this one.
And he's going to relate this. And then he gets to have the mic drop on, you know, the saga.
That's interesting.
That he gets to close it out. I don't think there's any way in the world that he did that. But part of me wants like that for him. Part of me wants him to release...
one in the fall and one in the spring.
Yeah, Song of Spring,
a
right?
Dream of Spring.
What it's called? Dream of Spring, right? So Winds of Winter, Dream of Spring, and then season 7 of Game of Thrones. Or Winds of Winter, season 7, Dream of Spring, season 8. I just want him to beat HBO now. And I like, you know, I want that for George. So,
although, like Sansa, he's had every chance to do it.
He's had a lot of chances
to say his part. Boy,
yeah.
So, which leads us to our next section.
Leads us to the actual Battle of the Bastards. Battle of the Bastards, which somehow is both thrilling in its execution and confusing in its setup. I don't know why I said somehow. A lot of things are like that. Batman v Superman was like that at certain points. So I don't necessarily say
I was never thrilled.
Oh man,
by that
we're
movie.
Gonna get some hate mail for comparing this to Batman v Superman.
It seemed like an apt thing to pull out of the ether for me, having enjoyed, you know, a solid 8 to 15 minutes of that movie.
Batman v Superman is a movie that came out.
I will say this: the difference is that in Batman v Superman, there's so much incoherence of like what story it's trying to tell. In this part of this episode, it's very clear what they're trying to do. Like the intention of the writers is not being hidden at all. They're playing up the drama of they want you to believe that John wasn't going to make it and that his forces were going to lose and that Ramsay was going to win again as long as possible and then bring in the Knights of the Vale. The problem is, if you've been paying attention, that did not all need to happen because of Sansa's withholding of information, which I know, Dave, is like your favorite thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a great television storytelling trope. It totally happens.
How do you feel about it in this context?
I feel like a lot of times trying to simplify this show has ended up telegraphing things. And Sansa not making this choice, it looks like from the next Dawns that we might deal with some of the fallout of that, is a mistake. I think they played it up so that we'd be on her side. But I think in the Game of Thrones that I liked from when we started doing Storm of Spoilers, which is this, you know, bleak world where there aren't any real heroes because actions have consequences, I think Sansa really fits into that that portrait. She made a lot of mistakes and it cost people her life, and that's something the Starks do. She's just kind of going about it in like a colder way.
And the Tullys.
I guess when it's contrasted against Jon being stupid and invincible at the same time, it really stands out as two things that didn't need to occupy the same space to up the stakes. I feel like at any time, even if they were waiting for the Knights of the Vale, if Ramsay pulled Rickon out, you know, Jon still wouldn't listen to Sansa and he would still screw up any plan they had. Like, they could be in the middle of digging the trenches, and I think Jon still would have run out to save Rickon. So I don't think there was a story reason to build this situation, and I think in, like, the attempt to make us feel thrilled when Jon is snatched from death by the Knights of the Vale arriving, ended up, if not betraying how characters are, tipping their hand to how simple they are way before they needed to, and therefore in an anticlimactic way. That being said, the portrayal of medieval battles after just showing us dragons torching a boat was great, and I think that like the Saving Private Ryan horror of like almost being trampled and like a pile of bodies, which are both like historically accurate things, would have played as horrific no matter what the stakes. So I feel like there are a lot of pieces and moments that worked for me, but when you step back and look at how it's assembled, it just wasn't done as efficiently as I wanted, which is basically like the same gripe I had with Jurassic World when I stop and think about it.
You just compare this to Batman v Superman and Jurassic World?
Those are both very popular things.
What was I going to say? Yeah, I really do feel like and this point I'm writing fan fiction, I will admit, but if Sansa had said, I sent this to Littlefinger, I'm not sure if he's coming, but I think he's coming. And then John rode off anyway and did some stupid shit anyway. And all throughout the battle then, we're like, is Littlefinger gonna come or not? We don't know. Sansa said she sent the letter, but we don't know if they're coming. Like, we would be as much in doubt as to whether or not they were coming with that. We being the close watchers, the people who, like, never bothered to follow up on who Sansa wrote that scroll to a couple episodes ago, might have been completely shocked by the arrival of the Knights of the Vale. And we talked about that last week.
I mean, it'd even be better if they didn't have the scroll scene in that episode.
Yeah.
Because then it just pops out of nowhere, and at least then we've all been deceived by Sansa.
I did want to mention, you mentioned the medieval battle, and I wanted to mention this great piece that I, you know, because in both the post episode and in the extended video, 12-minute video, Anatomy of a Scene, Weiss and Medieff talked about their martial inspirations, the Battle of Cannae, some Civil War battles and that sort of thing, and how they planned this battle based on a lot of history that they read. But Stephen Atwell, who writes at raceforTheIronThrone.wordpress.com, wrote about the episode. He had some like good thing to say and some negative things, but he said a couple battle things that I thought were interesting. Like, first, this is a plot thing. He says, John charging the front lines by himself is ridiculously dumb, even for genre fare. He basically spends the entire battle as a common foot soldier and never issues a single command. For all the show claims to be undermining tropes, idiot heroes getting saved by Deus Ex Machina is as tropey as you get. Let's have our heroes earn a victory or two by being smart for once. And then he also says, I also have a big problem with how Ramsay's encirclement was shown in practice. Given that we've seen two cavalry charges in the middle of the field, the infantry have a long way to go before they actually get into position. But no one on the northern side reacts to what's going on or attempts a breakout. And if you're going to have a giant phalanx encirclement, why do you put the umbers in the middle except for a preference for friendly fire? And then the last... And I think these are, like, generally good criticisms. I'm not picking nits. I think this is, like, some good I know my shit when it comes to battle criticism. The last thing he said was, the giant wall of the dead looked quite cinematic, but it's not going to happen with an open field battle like that, where people are clashing up and down the line. You only get that phenomenon when you have a large body of men trying to take or defend a single bottleneck. Hence, close up the wall with our English dead. I did like John getting trampled by his own men. That part was quite realistic. So I think that those are good. Like, I agree that the visuals of the battle, like, especially John running out into the field and dodging arrows and dodging headless Neds on horses and all that sort of stuff looked so cool. But when you break down the logic of the battle itself, it also doesn't hold up quite as well. So
I agree. But it looked rad. And I think,
it did look rad.
I think you really have to appreciate the very cinematic nature which Miguel Sapochnik shot this episode. And the stunts were amazing. I mean, this is really another level for Thrones. Visually, and it's true, some of the logic is like, yeah, this doesn't work. Also, like, why didn't 1-1 pick up a giant tree and use that? Like, why didn't he have any weapons? So there's a lot of, like, there are a lot of logical problems, and I think those seem obvious if you're paying attention. And I also I'm a firm believer that even though the problems seem obvious, that doesn't mean this was a bad episode. Like, this, it was still an enjoyable episode. The watch party that I was having with my roommates and some friends was riveted. Like, this episode still did its job. It just did it kind of in a specific way that traded logic for drama, which is fine. I mean, it's TV. If I think we sometimes just expect a little bit more, but here's a question. And this is the last time I'm going to go back to the Sansa thing. Because this actually would be the only Game of Thrones, like, super high-mind Game of Thrones reason for this. Do you think that Sansa, since she said, oh, Rickon's going to die anyway, like, obviously, do you think that she was, I don't want to say actively doing this, but do you think that she was sort of readily sacrificing John?
A lot of people seem to think that, and I don't want to believe that of Sansa.
But she did, you know, learn from the Littlefinger's school of turning on people.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Like, that is a possibility, but it's just, like, the darkest timeline for this character. And also, that's a reference to Community, which was an NBC sitcom. It's also the... Another suggestion that someone made to me was that since she decided that Rickon was a pawn that they were not going to get back, no matter what, had she been manipulating John into this position since way back at the wall when they got the letter and it was like, we have your brother Rickon. She wanted John to help her take Rintafel, and she used Rickon as a motivation for him. Like, she didn't write the letter, obviously, like Ramsay did, but she was like, we need to get our brother. But knowing the whole time that she was never going to get Rickon back.
I mean, I think it's a theory that gives Sansa a lot of credit that maybe we're not ready to give her, considering what we know about her throughout the series. But it does kind of, there's a little merit to it. One, she has a very healthy distrust of other people that is well earned. She's also playing, I think in my piece this week, I wrote that, you know, it seems like they're playing two different games, her and John. Like, John is playing the, we need to unite the people, we need to take back our stronghold, like, the crazy shit is coming. Whereas Sansa might still be playing the Game of Thrones. She hasn't advanced to the War of Ice and Fire yet. So, this idea that she would not necessarily want John to die, but be kind of okay with it because it really solidifies her position, is something that I wouldn't put necessarily past her. It's darker. It makes her out to be a little bit more conniving and evil than she probably is. But I don't think she is seeing the whole huge picture yet. I also think that in Thronesian, it's one of those decisions that people make and then they pay for it dearly later. And I think we're not gonna have to wait. Like, Littlefinger is gonna ask for some creepy shit next week.
Right. So. And I mean, I'm kind of okay with the logic of it if they are setting Sansa on the path to be a full blown villain. If you see Arya and Jon and Bran sort of leaning back into their Stark heritage and her leaning away towards becoming like a full blown villain, like, I don't want to get wild with my Mad Queen Daenerys predictions or anything like that, but I could see her. She's obviously like studied at the school of Baelish and Bolton in this episode. And as many people predicted, and I just didn't want, she's seeming to embody the Lady Stoneheart qualities of just cold vengeance, vengeance uber alles. You know, like, I'll string up Brienne and Pod in the name of vengeance. I'll send Jon into battle in the name of vengeance, you know? And I can sympathize why all the shit she went through would get her there. It's just not what I would... It's a further tragedy. I don't see it as a victory for Sansa. I see it as a further tragic chapter of her story.
Right. I feel like,
yeah,
honestly, it would be more impactful tragedy. Like, it would be just more gut destroying if it ended up with Sansa being kind of a bad guy. Like, then it would Daenerys, like, not saying that Daenerys wouldn't be, but like, with Daenerys, it's always kind of been under the surface, like, this potential to be crazy. But with Sansa, it's a real transformation.
Well, is it?
That's interesting. I mean, she was bratty. She was bratty as a kid.
She lied to the point of, like, she threw her sister under the bus, right? Uh-huh. She got some direwolves killed.
It's true. I mean, this all informs this potential theory. I do think it's more heartbreaking because we've seen her go through so much bad shit. And you really wanted her to get her revenge, but then the more Game of Thrones thing, which my only holdback from like being all in on this is that I don't think the show is as smart as George has been about this like long form trickery. But it really does feel like the next logical step is for her to go a little too far.
I think, and I'm sorry, like, I want to hear more from Dave, but I want to say one last like book dependent thing, which I think some people are wondering if in the books it's actually Stannis leading the charge outside the battle for Winterfell. It's still a possibility that it's Stannis' forces, not Jon's, at the Winterfell. And then also wondering if Sansa does show up, like, with Littlefinger as a deus ex machina, because she's in the Vale. She doesn't have to, like, skulk around her tents, meet up with Littlefinger somewhere, hop on a horse and ride up with him. She would be riding up with him to begin with because she would be coming from the Vale to rescue everyone. So that might still be a thing that happens. And in that case, probably Sansa would be more Littlefinger's pawn, given the version of her in the books mm-hmm. that we've seen, than this someone who's doing any kind of plotting herself. But that's all pure speculation. But that's, you know, one explanation for why we needed this Knights of the Vale deus ex machina and had to really contort the plot to get there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. I have said in everything I've written since the episode that the most interesting thing about this battle will be what happens next. And we should absolutely enjoy what it is, which is really impressive visual work from the show. The other thing that I wanted to say before we...
Yeah, go ahead. Let me interrupt you really quickly. Isn't it better when character marries visuals like we saw in Meereen?
Sure.
When we saw Tyrion being the most Tyrion he's been, when we saw some great stuff from Yara and Dany, and we got all the polygons Dave could ever want. Like, that's the show, the ideal of the show. And then we got that in Blackwater, I think in Hardhome as well. You know, that's what I want the show to be. And so when it does excel visually, as it did in the Battle of the Bastards, then it just makes me miss the character and story stuff that I feel like would make for just an ecstatic viewing experience for me.
Yeah, so. That's true. And I think for me, of the episode nines, I think this falls somewhere in the middle. You know, you have obviously Baelor and Reigns of Castamere above it, and Blackwater and Hardhome. It really felt like
Hardhome, I think, was eight.
Dance
with Dragons.
So it would be, for me, if I had to rank the episode nines, which would be Baelor, Reigns of Castamere, Blackwater, because Blackwater does that really well. Blackwater does the marrying of the political drama with the big action. Mm-hmm. And then this one, and then Watchers on the Wall and Dance with Dragons are kind of tied for fifth. But I thought this one, the visuals were much better than Watchers on the Wall.
Agreed.
But it didn't quite get to Blackwater level for me. And also, I think there's a piece of me that likes Blackwater a little better because I know that they were working with a much smaller budget and it was still really impressive. Like, they were scrappy back then in season two. And now it's just like, well, they had like infinite budget for this. So they could have done whatever they wanted. So, of course, it looks great.
One, I swear I'm going to throw it to Dave, but one weird spoiler dependent criticism that I've gotten from people who are upset that I didn't like the episode is that they think that I am ruining the experience for myself by spoiling myself on it, by knowing that the Knights of the Vale are coming, by knowing that Jon was going to survive, by knowing Tormund was going to survive because of this massive Reddit leak that happened over the summer, or I don't know, a couple months ago, that I spoiled it for myself. But like, I knew the outcome of the Battle of Blackwater, and that spoiled nothing for me. Spoiled my enjoyment zero. Like, we have been operating for years knowing the outcome of Raids of Castamere. Like, having read the book, we already knew it was going to happen. And so knowing what the outcome, this might as well be the motto of Storm of Spoilers, is not ruin, you know, your viewing experience. My criticisms are not, I think, stemming from that. Dave, what are your thoughts on all this?
Which part?
I don't know. Sorry.
Whichever part you want, buddy.
I really was thrilled by the episode as an episode of television in terms of moving the pieces along. It didn't really that much, which means I can't really dislike it for not moving them in a way I don't like. Because it's not, you know, and having known the episode really only means that the thrill I got this week was purely visual. It wasn't story-based. It was more like, how are they going to pull this off? And in terms of how are they going to pull this off, they pulled it off well. I mean, thinking about it as one in a line of a season, we've been padding our fall for our Sansa withholding information. So it's like, when that happened in the moment, I was more like, oh, I wasn't like, oh, God, there goes the goddamn episode now. It's all pointless. This is horrible. or like, you know, yelling zigzag at the screen when, you know, Rickon's running isn't nitpicking the show. It's being engaged with the show in the moment. So I feel like I was able to appreciate it on that level. When it got to trying to figure out if they meant to do what they did with Sansa, I sort of had to backtrack to what, like, Littlefinger's overall plan is, and I realized that, at least on the show, no idea about the books, but Sansa has, you know, become the way she plays the game is mostly based on Littlefinger, and how Littlefinger plays the game is very different from how Varys plays the game, because Varys has little birds and relationships, and he knows people and he has patience, and Littlefinger knows how people are going to react when they're provoked and has absolutely no patience. And the failing for, like, both of them is that they won't they trust facts and won't trust people, so sometimes they can't get a good read on people. Littlefinger might have not been able to get a good read on Ramsay, and Sansa definitely didn't get a good read on, you know, or had the perfect read on Jon. Just because it makes her a, you know, smart but cold-hearted character doesn't mean she didn't have the right read. But they both have that blind spot. So if Littlefinger's downfall began when Sansa's rise began in, what, season 4 in the Vale, then I think we're not going to necessarily see Sansa go so too far as much as she might have the power to now, like, snuff out Littlefinger's season-long plan.
I agree. Like, if they're turning Sansa into a villain, my next move for her, I hope, the next thing I want to see her do is bust Littlefinger to Robin and Waymar Royce, or not, not Waymar, anyway, Lord Royce, and say, like, yeah, he legit murdered Lysa. Get rid of him.
Right.
And then his hold on her, over her is done. So that would be a great thing for evil Darth Sansa to do. Like, I can get on board with rooting for Darth Sansa if that's what they're doing.
I mean, her other option
kind of seems to be.
Like, I feel like just from the next time on, and this kind of leads us into our next section, is her other option might be like, oh, well, now you have to marry him because that's what he's going to want.
If Sansa has to, like, if Sansa just goes back into, like, the other political pawn, marry someone for power role, I mean, fuck that, right?
I'd rather, like, her be evil. I'd rather her try to kill Jon again.
I'd rather her be Lady Sansa Stark's heart. I'd rather she, like, poison Jon. I mean, what we're probably going to if we don't get that, what I hope we see is Sansa and Jon fighting over who gets to be Monarch of the North. Mm-hmm. I think our spoilers, I mean, fast forward if you want, I guess, but I think our spoilers indicate that it's Jon who gets crowned King of the North, backed by...
Them's the rumors. That's what I'm calling them. Them's the rumors.
Backed by the three remaining members of House Mormont. you know, she...
Which are worth 30 men.
Yeah.
And Lyanna Mormont's scowl alone is worth like 100. So
it's true.
Yeah.
But if Sansa feels like she should be Queen of the North because she's actually a Stark, and Jon gets it because he's a dude, you know, there's some opportunity for some social justice warrioring of her to do if she wants to in the North. I just think that, like, if like the best possible outcome for Sansa would be to be used, manipulated, raped, tormented, all of this stuff, and then come out the other side clean and strong. And she's going to come out the other side strong and evil. Then, in my opinion, Ramsay's right. He wins. Like, a little, she can never kill him if she becomes
him.
Oh,
man.
So, you know.
That's so much more interesting than the theory that we're totally not going to talk about with regards to that Ramsay thing. But this notion that his evil is part of her, like that he is somehow broken her in a way that she will never be able to trust. I mean, that's some deep, deep psychological stuff. Whew, man, that's... I feel like we're giving the show too much credit right now, but...
We often do.
If that's the case, that's really good storytelling. Like, it's not... fun, but it's super tragic. Yeah. And
that sounds like Game of Thrones.
So I guess we'll find out, but man, I think we got something here, guys.
I don't think it's okay. So we have Littlefinger and Sansa and Jon in Winterfell, and they're going to be the three people arguing for power. Does if Sansa ditches Littlefinger's claim for marriage, does Littlefinger immediately reveal the Tower of Joy to legitimize Jon?
Ooh, he does have that trump card.
That is interesting.
And that would immediately solve the bastard question, and nobody would have to get married, but Sansa would also have to be second to the Lord of Winterfell.
That's counter to information I have.
Oh.
But...
No, hit me with the information. I got my theory out. What's the other theory?
Well, I believe that we're going to get... Well, we know... We all know pretty... For pretty certain that we're going to get the final chapter of the Tower of Joy in this week's episode. And flashback Bran style, we're going to get Lyanna saying, promise me, with the baby, and then cut to Jon. I believe that that's what's going to happen. Whether or not it's explicitly confirmed, I don't know. But I think they're going to do that to draw as heavy a line between what we saw in the Tower of Joy and Jon Snow for those five people out there who have not spoiled themselves yet on R plus L equals
J. Also, though, here's a question.
Yeah.
Legitimizing Jon wouldn't necessarily make him the Lord of Winterfell.
No, it wouldn't.
Because he's not... All he's Ned's not Ned's son. He's actually Ned's nephew. He mm-hmm. just would then technically be the Targaryen heir,
right?
Because he would be
right.
Rhaegar's. Well, actually, he's still Rhaegar's bastard, so that still doesn't count.
Yeah, he's
they're all
still
fighting
a bastard,
over a throne
no
that's not
going
to exist in like 6 days.
yeah,
but I think the more interesting play would be, well, I think it'd be interesting if Bran came back, because Bran actually is the heir to Winterfell.
I would love that, to have Sansa and Jon fight and be like, no, I deserve it. No, I mean, and not that Jon would fight. Jon would just give it to Sansa. Like, Jon would not
right.
care.
Just like he was trying to listen to her in the planning of this battle, and she still didn't tell him, and that's really frustrating.
But if they were fighting, let's just say they were, and then Bran shows up, and they're like, oh, man, the cripple kid. Damn it.
And then Jon falls in love with Mira, and all the fan theories are true.
Jon falls in love with Mira and then finds out she's his sister. It's just
boy. What else do we think is going to happen next week? I already mentioned the burning
down. I got
down
a question.
Oh no, go ahead.
I think Dave has more Littlefinger.
Can't get in the way of Dave and Littlefinger.
I mean,
no,
I don't think
cannot.
It's Littlefinger based, but is a problem solved if Sansa marries Jon?
It's a really creepy way to solve it.
Okay, we know exactly why this marriage would be happening, and it would not be sex. Although he does like gingers.
I don't think so. I don't think that it solves... Because Jon still doesn't have any... well, unless he is legitimized by the crown as Ned's son, he has no technical legal claim. So I don't think... I really think that Littlefinger's play is... He's going to marry Sansa, and then he's the Warden of the North, which is what he told Cersei he wanted to do. And it doesn't matter, because it doesn't matter who else Sansa marries, because she's already done it twice. Obviously, it doesn't matter.
I feel like Lyanna Mormont would have backed Sansa, because, you know, she knows something about being a woman in this position.
I would back Sansa, too. I think...
But,
you know, we don't get to... You know, the law is the law, guys.
No. Lyanna is the head of House Mormont.
Oh,
she's
Lyanna
woman,
Mormont.
Right?
I thought we were talking about Lyanna Stark.
No, Lyanna. I have been confusing those names a lot, but hopefully I meant Lyanna Mormont. That phrase I uttered earlier was a reference to the film Shakespeare in Love. but I feel like she would have backed Sansa if Sansa hadn't pulled this bullshit. You know, like, why would Lyanna back Jon? Why wouldn't she back Sansa if she believes that women should rule and, you know, Sansa is a Stark or, I guess, a Lannister or
Well, and
a
also, that's interesting that you bring up Lyanna Mormont, because she is the lady of Bear Island in absence of a male heir. So I guess what that informs us as far as the law, at least in the show's rules, is that a woman can be in charge of lands.
Oh, yeah, that is the simplest solution. That's so, what's going to happen.
So Sansa doesn't need to marry anyone. She's just the heir to Winterfell now until she marries and has a son. Kind of like Tommen died, Cersei would be
queen. That's by show logic.
Within the rules of the show. Actually, I mean, it's the same in the books.
But she said the opposite. She said Rickon is Ned Stark's last male heir. You know,
well,
like,
that's because...
Oh, because Rickon's dead and Bran's presumed dead, she's the only heir.
Rickon posed a direct threat to Ramsay, whereas Sansa didn't because she's technically his wife.
No, but I mean, if let's say Rickon had run Serpentine and made it to the other side, Rickon would be the Lord of Winterfell.
That's true, but now that he's dead...
But now he's dead, but Bran is out there. But in absentia, well, they do know he's not dead.
Well, they know that he
well, they
wasn't
do know he might not be dead.
They don't
wait,
know
wait,
that he's
wait.
Still alive.
Right.
A, she took it by force, so possession's 9/10. B, she's the eldest surviving member of House Bolton, so doesn't she just, like, inherit all that shit?
No, the Stark banners are flying
so
at Winterfell.
As far as they know, Sansa's the only living Stark child that is a full Stark child.
I know that, like, people have been doing the same thing and having fun with the Iron Throne, and I've been so, like, dismissive of it. Like, it doesn't matter.
They're about to light that shit on fire.
For Tommen after he throws himself out a window, but it is fun to talk about. I apologize for that. It's fun to talk about who
it
would
does
take
make
over
sense. Like, she's now the essentially the regent of Winterfell. She's not necessarily the Lord because
she's the regent until
right,
she like Cersei
Queen of
until she
like
has
the
a baby.
Queen of England's still the queen.
Yeah.
And her son, I don't, let's not do this.
Well, and then John knows that Bran's alive, right?
But John,
no, he doesn't.
No, he does not. He intentionally does, like, that has intentionally been withheld from him by Sam.
No,
or did
Sam
tell him in the show?
Did he
I
tell
thought
him?
Maybe Sam told him in the show.
Somebody
but not
email
in the
books. Us and tell us, because I don't feel like going back and watching the
Yeah,
books.
Because Sansa definitely knows that Arya is alive, because Brienne told her. So they right. All they know is that Rickon's dead, as far as...
And they assume Bran is dead at this point. Like, even if Sam told Jon, Bran's still going north of the Wall. Like, you have to assume that he's not going to make it.
Well, I'm just talking about in terms of a claim to... The Starks having a claim to Winterfell, it's more than just them being there. There's evidence that there's a lot of Starks that are still alive. They're not nearly as wiped out as everybody thinks they are.
That's true. Yeah, but as far as, like, actual Starks who are there who could do some ruling, it's just Sansa at this point and half of Jon.
Right. But there isn't enough pushback that there's going to be, like, a citizen's revolt. It's just Littlefinger, Sansa, Jon.
Nobody's going to be like, wait, we have to wait for Bran.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I
now
don't
that
know
we put everybody to sleep
that.
With the lineage.
Yeah.
Well, what I will say is that if Sansa feels like she has a more, I mean, it's sort of like Stannis versus Renly, right? Sansa has the technical claim, but Jon might be more popular by virtue of penis. Who knows? Like, he's the Bernie to her Hillary. I don't know. But, like, if he gets the votes. Oh, God. Sorry. You can edit that out if you want. If he gets
the
votes.
That's okay. We already got all the negative reviews in that 5 seconds.
If he gets the votes, she, you know, she has reason to go even darker and ally herself even more with Littlefinger if she feels like her claim to Winterfell was wrongfully taken from her by Jon.
And I do think that it's important. Like, I believed through this entire episode that Jon was acting in earnest at all times. And then right after when he's trying to listen to Sansa, he kind of gave her a moment to be like, hey, like, if you don't think this is going to work, tell me what will. And we've always believed that Jon is a very honorable guy like his father. But then after the episode, in the post episode thing, Benioff was on there talking about the scene where he's punching Ramsay and how there's something dead inside of Jon now. And the show is still interpreting this in a weird way that hasn't totally come to fruition. So, like, part of me historically wants to believe that Jon would not fight Sansa for rule of Winterfell, whereas Sansa still has a darker place that she could go. But maybe the show still thinks Jon has a darker place to go.
Sometimes Weiss and Benioff say things that, strange. I just don't understand. Like, Tyrion was doing a great job all season, which is something that they said in the post-episode interview. And I was like, no, Tyrion is doing a bad job until Dany came back, and then he suddenly remembered how to politic again. Like, anyway. Yeah, well, that's interesting to me. If they're trying to show, I mean, I think that's true that Jon beating Ramsay to a pulp, which is a spoiler we've had for months, was something like I was hoping we would see from him this season in terms of a darkness. I don't think they've done a really good job demonstrating that outside of that one encounter. And I wish we had seen more of it, like a ruthlessness. I didn't see it in battle either. I just saw him desperately trying to survive and almost getting trampled. But
interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel like they're quite selling that for me.
We'll see.
Yeah, I think simplest solution is one scene where she apologizes, one scene where Littlefinger's like, marry me. And she's like, a mysterious half smile, and then you know, off to season 7 with her.
Right, there's not a lot of room to go. Yeah, I agree. That's what we've seen in the trailer. That's probably all we're going to get.
And this is, I have the perfect segue into our next segment. If we're done. It feels like a trend to me that the best stuff in every episode is not in the next time on. Like, completely not there. For various reasons. The Hound stuff during that episode couldn't be in there because it's a huge spoiler. But, like, the Marine stuff that they held back was, like, the best part of this episode. So,
but I don't think that's why they held it back. I think they held it back because they were trying to pretend that this was a one-long battle episode. That's a really cynical read.
Yeah,
on this
you got
Battle of the Bastards
a bunch of cynical
thing.
Reads on things. Look, no one promised you a good Sansa, Joanna. Game of Thrones character.
I feel like it goes to this the notion like them not doing plot descriptions, no screeners, like they're trying to hold back their best stuff. Like there was no avoiding showing some of the battle. But they could totally avoid showing the Marine stuff, and it would be this delightful surprise when we finally got to it. So my wonder is, what's not in the preview for next week?
I'm gonna go to Joanna first. I feel bad for snapping at her.
Oh, that was fine. I think that. It's less, I don't think they're completely concealing anything, or they might be completely concealing some things, but I think it's more like the fallout, like the Frey banquet or Cersei's trial. Like if you haven't been putting the wildfire dots together, which they've been laying out so clearly for us
in
the last few episodes. Yep, they sure did. If you're not following that, and that's fine, then you, for all you know, Cersei's having her trial next week, and that's what's happening. A Cersei trial, instead of kaboom. So, you know, and the Freys and the Lannisters are having a nice dinner, as opposed to, I don't know, Arya shows up and murders everyone. I think the only thing that we haven't seen, well, yeah, you know what? Daenerys landing her motherfucking dragon in Dorne. That's the big mic drop.
Well, and
that,
then everything,
you know, we might
as
see.
It relates to Bran, the Wall, the Night King. So, like, we see Bran.
Right.
We know
yes.
that he's going to have another vision about the Tower of Joy. But, like, there's got to be something else there, you know? Like, someone taking down the Wall.
I don't think the Wall is coming down. I don't think the Wall is coming down. But I've been wrong about Sons of Harpies, so I don't know.
I want to go with Wall
Dave,
coming down, but like really towards the end, and just because we did the Night King's magic touch this season, I think keeping that logic in one season, even if it's like right at the end, it would be worthwhile. Like I think, even if the Wall doesn't come tumbling down, someone like Uncle Benjen telling Bran that he like broke the spell or something, definitely would be enough for me. Just knowing that the goddamn Game of Thrones isn't going to matter because Cersei blew most things up, I'm really looking forward to, you know, having a nice little chaos end to what we thought was so important and pivoting. Especially if they're going to do the dragons as well.
I will... I will say that we were worried about, we had fun thinking about how Cersei might die in episode 10. And I know Neil has been quite worried about Jaime being at that Frey feast in episode 10. But this is a behind the scenes spoiler, so feel free to fast forward. Deadline just this afternoon posted an article about which actors have re-upped their contracts through season 8.
And, here we go.
Lena Headey, Kit Harington, Emilia Clarke, Peter Dinklage, and Nicola Coster-Waldau all have contracts through at least through season 7 and then options for season 8. So I think they're at least, I'm not ready to make huge bold predictions about that, but I believe that those people are all going to be safe through the finale, and we're just going to see the decimation of House Tyrell instead. So. Or the information
could
be wrong.
Well, it also wasn't...
But Deadline, Hollywood Reporter released a similar article 2 years ago about contract negotiations in 2014. And all those people who re-upped their contract are still alive on the show. So I think that it means something. Hmm. I do.
I wanted Cersei to die. Boo. Deadline ruins everything. No, it's Joanna ruins everything. This isn't the first thing they've ruined for me.
Although, man, they're all making like $500,000 an episode. That's awesome. Good for them.
Yeah, that's crazy. My problem with this, I had the same issue with the 2014 story, is that that's the A level. That's the A tier, those five names. And so it's upsetting that on the B tier are Sophie Turner and Maisie Williams, that they are on a different salary negotiation. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that they were kids when they first started on Game of Thrones, so they started from like a lower place. But there is much.
And Isaac Hempstead gets paid like $10 an hour.
Any of those. $10 an hour in free haircuts.
Poor Art Parkinson probably got like $20 because they're like, well, you don't have any lines, you just have to run.
They're like actors equity.
You just have to run in a straight line.
So I
just
don't,
straight.
Like the Jaime thing, I am worried about Jaime being there, but it doesn't necessarily mean he has to die. The Lena Headey thing is also not that huge of a spoiler because there are plenty of ways for her to burn down all of King's Landing without dying. Like, I don't think she's going to die. And it's funny, we talked about last week that the theory that I had about her going to the Riverlands and now apparently toward the Twins, if that's where Jaime is, and getting caught by the Brotherhood led by Arya, that's still in play.
Was that shot at
shot
at the Twins, or was that inside
I could be wrong,
Riverrun?
Obviously, but
I don't know.
It kind of had the same look of the Twins from the Red Wedding.
I thought it was the Twins just because Walder Frey doesn't seem like the guy that would go anywhere.
That's a good point.
You're right.
Too.
He doesn't travel. You're very right.
Not enough okay. bus to slap everywhere. Sorry, Neil. So what is going to go down there? We're going to get some sort of pie thing. We're going to get Arya faceless Manning.
I mean, the pie thing seems tough because it requires some setup and it requires introduction of Manderlys. Although, didn't they cast for a big fat lord?
They did. Some people think maybe that was cut since, but they did cast for someone who looks very much like Lord Manderly. So I don't know if they were like replaced him with Lord Glover or what, or if it's going to happen. But yeah, I'm very intrigued about that banquet for sure.
Unless nothing's going to happen and it's just going to be this weird like moment of victory, quote unquote, for the Lannisters and the technically bad guys as King's Landing is like burning down. Like this sort of like bittersweet juxtaposition of like, oh, Jaime is a winner and Cersei just literally burned down the capital of Westeros.
So in terms of people in that area, do we think Brienne and Pod throw in? Are they more likely to show up there than instead of Arya, since book wise those two are supposed to be at odds, Jaime and Brienne?
Maybe, but they don't really have any business.
What if?
Like they
sorry.
Oh god. No, go, because I really, my answer is like, no.
What if all the Freys die, but Jaime gets out, and he's on the run, and he's like friendless because he just left, like, you know, the Freys, and he encounters Bran and Pod, Freyless and alone.
That does get them to kind of his book ending,
right? Like, I want those Freys to die, Jaime in his plot armor to make it out, and for him to be reunited with Bran, because we love, is you can ship Tormund and Bran as you know, as much as you want, but you have to admit that they're each other's best scene partners, I think. You know, you can believe in the love of Tormund and Bran, but know that Bran and Jaime in a scene is magic, so.
It's definitely a situation where Brienne brings out the best in Tormund, but then Jaime and Brienne, it's sort of a more mutual thing. Yeah. So.
Up north, we're going to have some Melisandre business. I completely left that out of my
I do think it's quick. On this specific one, I think it's interesting that they showed Davos not, like, just killing her, but, like, tattling on her with Jon. I find that to be, I mean, it's pretty much the most Davos thing possible. It's like, instead of getting revenge, he's like going through the legal system.
Yep.
So, but yeah, that'll be interesting to see what happens to Melisandre. She, you know, she was the catalyst of the whole season. So is this the end for her?
I mean, it would be interesting if Jon finally got to cut somebody's head off. In Winterfell,
the woman who brought him,
he hasn't gotten to do that yet.
The woman who brought him back from the dead,
and he
come back from this.
he would be really torn, I guess, because you're right. I mean, she is the one who brought him back. He didn't know Shireen, like he doesn't have any, you know, stake in this whole situation. So it's really a question of, like, who does Jon value more? With limited knowledge, Melisandre or Davos.
Yeah, well, I mean, he could also just be pissed off with the Lord of Light and take it out that way. I don't know. It would be interesting if he, like, chopped off Melisandre's head and then, like, the Hound and, like, Thoros of Myr come through the front gate and are like, what? Oh, well, we have one, too. are we gonna see that? Are we gonna see what Hound decides to do this
Well,
season?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple check-ins that we could have, because there's Jorah Mormont out there in the world. And
looking for the ointment.
And then there's, the Hound and the brothers going, the Brotherhood going north. So are we going to see them, you know, traveling? It would be nice to see them, like, even in, like, a Losty musical montage of them just, like, doing their shit on the move.
They've also, they've been gone for, like, what, two episodes now? One episode.
They could be anywhere.
They could be north of the wall for now.
Right. They could all be in a shy. Like, Jorah could be on another planet at this point for how long he's been gone. So.
Yeah.
Do we think the Brotherhood could maybe, I don't know, massacre the Freys?
They could help Arya do it.
It seems like, well, I guess they all, that, you know, if Arya happens across the Brotherhood and the Hound is there, I guess that would be, like, the easiest to convince group of people to help you kill the Freys.
I think given how much they're fond of, like, leaps of logic with Arya's plot, I really do feel like we're going to see her wearing the face of that little girl who was getting her ass slapped by Walder Frey, even though it would mean that she would have to kill her and, like, take off her face in a non-mystical House of Black and White sort of way and slap it on hers. Like, I don't know that that's possible, but I feel like Arya stabbing Walder Frey and then whipping off that face is the kind of thing the show would do. I'm not saying it makes all the sense in the world, but I feel like that's the big, like, what the fuck Arya moment that we might get in the finale.
It's the, hey, I didn't tell you about the Knights of the Vale moment. Oh, by the way,
Arya can change faces. Let's not talk about it. It's cool. Don't even worry. Don't ask any questions.
Man, yeah. I mean, I think if they do the face changing thing, there's butt slapping Frey, obviously. But, like, I could also see the show just, like, panning over the crowd and the waifs there, and we're supposed to go, oh, even though it doesn't make any logical sense.
Right.
Because that's how the show occasionally goes.
And you know what? Sometimes it doesn't have to. It's fantasy, but it's better if it makes sense, guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm excited to see the Freys die. I anticipate that they're going to. I'm excited to see you know, I believe Marjorie and Loras and Mace are going to get their ass blown up. It's going to be fun. So, you know,
well, and Tommen's not going to survive somehow.
For sure.
All right.
Gold shroud for Tommen.
Out the window.
And then I don't think we had predictions for Marine, but we definitely, there were some in the next nuns of some pep talking. The game is terrifying, guys.
Oh, yeah. And then, like, Danny, like, tenderly touching Daria's face. So weird. I was like, I care so little about this, whatever's happening here. Unless she's telling him that she's dumping him for Yara, I don't care about that scene. So, yeah.
Would that violate the speed of travel to start in Marine and then end with Danny landing somewhere?
Not at all, because it's a 59-minute episode. So if it starts in Marine and then 57 minutes later, we're in Dorne. I think that that works within the logic of the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's possible. Like it, and that could be like the last minute before they set off for Westeros. Like Danny's having this like existential crisis. Like, should I leave Marine and go? Like, is this really what I'm here to do? And Tyrion has to kind of pump her up a little bit.
Maybe she leaves Daario behind. Maybe she's like, sorry, I gotta go. You and Grey Worm and Miss Cindy, you crack political minds.
The second
minds.
Sons are the smallest portion of my force.
Yeah,
now.
So you gotta stay in Marine. I just can't leave it, buddy. And I got a new bed buddy now. So, yeah. Bye-bye.
Your days riding the dragon are over.
So we are going to get Old Town in this season, correct? Like, it's...
I don't know.
So we're going to see...
What do we have to learn there?
We have... I mean, Sam could learn some stuff. There's still some Sam stuff to wrap up, potentially, unless they hold that till next season. But also, in the next week on, we get the White Raven flying toward Winterfell, which is a very Old Town thing. It's the Maesters sending out the White Raven to inform the rest of Westeros that winter is officially here. You know, it's like when like you log into Facebook and it's like, it's the first day of summer. It's basically that, but for Westeros. And the White Ravens have a lot of significance to book readers. And so I picked that right out of the thing and I was like, oh, awesome. But that also could mean that like maybe there's a prologue to the episode, or maybe the first scene is like Old Town. Because they as far as I know, they picked a location for it, right? Like
That was the rumor, but it might have been.
It might have just been more
like other, King's Landing or something like that, you know.
So it's, I think it's possible that we may get some of that, especially toward the end of the episode when the wall's about to come down.
Someone told me that the White Raven was in season two. I haven't found evidence of that yet, but they told me that they thought the White Raven was released in season two. So,
yeah, I feel like that wasn't. I feel like that's not right.
Well, okay, in terms of like hanging plot lines, we have where did Varys go? So there's a possibility we flash over to Dorne. We had where did Lady Orlena go? So once again, maybe to Dorne.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Let me say really quickly. And behind the scenes on GameOfThrones.wikia.com, live ravens are used in most shots in which animal appears in cages. The rare White Raven, which Pycelle presents to the small council in season two, had to be brought in all the way from Austria. So, and that's from the Making of Thrones blog. So, I don't know if they're just like, forget that. Winter's for serious here this time.
It's interesting that they open the next week on with a shot of a White Raven.
No, I know. The White Raven's happening next week. It just is like the second White Raven. So,
guys, we're serious about winter this time.
Yeah, for real. Did you not get our last text? Winter is coming. Come on. Anyway. Sorry. Okay, right. you were saying, Dave. Dave,
are we missing any other dangling plot lines that we or that the television show is telegraphing that we might pick up by the end of the season?
I think that we believe that Varys and Olenna are going to be in Dorne, maybe to greet Daenerys, so we might see the Sand Snakes again. Dun dun dun.
We had those rumors. There's going to be wolf. Shooting,
yes,
or there was wolf
yes,
shooting.
The Nymeria wolf pack rumor. We believe that Qyburn and his little birds are going to take out Kevin and Pycelle. Yeah, I think those are most of the things, unless we plan to see Gendry again. I don't
Lady
know.
Stoneheart, obviously.
Clearly. Yeah. I mean, there's time for Cleganebowl, right? Before the season's over? Yeah,
they have 70 minutes in this last episode. Although
it,
it's just...
Is it 70?
It's supposed to be 69, although the Battle of the Bastards was 69 minutes, and like 20 minutes of that was the commercials and the Next Week On and all this. Like HBO Go had like 69 minutes. I was like, holy shit, this is a long episode. And then it was like all the other stuff is in that runtime. So
don't you want to know what happened on Ballers this week, Neil? That's not even on, is it?
It's coming back this summer. Ballers season 2.
We're going to... That's one of our stops. On our tour, great. We're going to be talking about Ballers every week.
Sweet. I love talking about the intricacies of sports contracts and Dwayne Johnson.
Though we might talk about Westworld, which got a cool preview in front of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Westworld looks pretty dope.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess as a way to wind down, not only can you tweet questions about Game of Thrones and email us questions about Game of Thrones to our Storm of Spoilers places, but now you could start suggesting other destinations for our pop culture road trip. We kind of like if there's multiple versions of it, like say a source material that we could talk about, or if there's something that has especially interesting spoilers. Those seem to be the Venn diagram that makes our show. Outside of the alchemy between myself and my co-hosts, where can we find more of each of us on the internet until next week? Let's continue, starting with Neil.
You can find me at filmschoolrejects.com, where I'll be writing a lot more about Game of Thrones this week, because it's my last grasp to get it all out there. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Rejects, and of course follow the show at Storm of Spoilers, where we will be tweeting all kinds of work from all three of us. Once Game of Thrones is over, we're going to be sharing all kinds of other stuff.
I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to me talk about Game of Thrones in a non-spoiler way on Cast of Kings. Or you can find my work on VanityFair.com. I will be taking a long vacation after Game of Thrones is over, though.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I'm on Twitter at DA7E. I write for Geek.com and Latino-Review.com. And thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week when the winds of winter come a-blowin'.